My name is Bo McCall. I'm originally from Philadelphia. I'm the first child of Velma Fambro and Harold McCall, my parents. I was born in Philadelphia. I'm 60 years old. We are in Harlem at the Langston Hughes house. I've just created a new piece of art. It's a kitchen table dedicated to the poem I Too by Langston Hughes.
And my name is Sandy Baker. I am a native New Yorker, and I kind of laugh and say I'm one of a laugh. The last of a dying breed, because you very seldom meet people who are born in Harlem and still live in Harlem and still move around.
Okay. Tell me about your parents.
My parents. Well, my dad died when I was really small, so probably about 2 years old, so I don't remember him that well. My mother just passed recently, and we had a great old time interacting. She was very mellow, quiet, but supportive. Okay. She didn't say a whole lot, but she was always like, okay, you want to do it? Go ahead. And that's where I got my energy.
Okay, so for your energy, looking at you, you're a very stylish woman. Did you get any of that from your mother?
I'm sure I did. I'm sure I did. I don't think, you know, one of the things that she always used to say when I was younger, with regard to jewelry and accessories, that a woman is not fully dressed until she has on all of her jewelry. Mm-hmm. And she would always check me out as I went through the door. Excuse me, where are your earrings? And I would put on and go about my business. And I think somewhere in there, I just kind of, that became inbred in me to always kind of put your best foot forward.
Okay. Now, looking at you, as a kid growing up, I'm gonna remember one year, one of my aunts on my father's side, she took a trip to Africa, and when she came back, she didn't have any hair. And then my mother cut her hair off, and my dad had a fit. But since then, this is way back when, my mother never grew her hair back. So we were known as the kids with the bald head mother.
Nice, I love
it. So when I see women that embrace their baldness, that embrace their natural hair, It's something about the energy in that, the power in that. I know life is about choices and the things that black people and black women do with their hair, but I think black women in their most, the rawest beauty they can have is their natural beauty, as far as the hair or hairless. I think you look great.
Well, thank you very much. I love it. It wasn't an original plan. Oh, but I would say this, I did this about 25 years ago. I made the mistake of doing micro braids in my hair. And on day 2.5 of combing out the micro braids, I hadn't made it to half of my head. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I'm wasting entirely too much time. And I went to a young man, Basir, who's a barber, who I had known as a child, and I said, I want it off. And he said, off? You mean off? I said, yes. And he did a shearing right through here that I said, okay, yes, okay, take it off, take it off. And the only problem I had initially is that my head was lighter than my face because it had been covered with hair.
Hair, yeah.
So across the room, you look like somebody who had blonde hair or what have you. So thankfully, I think I did it, it was April. And so I was praying for the spring and summer to come so I could run out and get my scalp tuned in with my face.
Get your tan on.
Yeah, get my tan on. And since then, I have not even given it a thought. I am so comfortable that I honestly don't even think about it anymore.
Is this a part of you?
Yeah, this is how I am. I like me. If you don't like me, well, that's your problem. But I haven't had any problems with that either, so I'm okay.
Exactly. Because growing up, I grew up in the projects, and it was this lady, Miss Peaches, who lived down the hall from us. Miss Peaches was a big woman, light-skinned woman, very attractive, and I don't know what happened this one day. She shaved all her head off. Every piece of hair, she shaved it off. And her makeup was, like, outstanding. And she had this big African caftan on. And I'm like, I probably was maybe about 10 years old.
That's wonderful.
And I saw her, I thought she was some kind of goddess, like she came from some other planet or something. Like, I couldn't believe she shaved her hair off, right, and then how good she looked. I just, like, every time I would see her, I would stare at her.
That's a wonderful experience.
It was great. And the memory is like still fresh in my head.
Wonderful. And she did a good job.
She did.
She did.
And then this was during the time of, we had just went from bouffant wigs to the Black Power movement, and Black folks was embracing their natural self. So that, to me, that was a big, bold statement for her to do at the time. And people, it was a lot of positive energy around her image. I just wanted to see more women do it, but it didn't happen.
Well, some women are uncomfortable. Some women think about it, but they feel if they don't get the reinforcement in advance of them doing it from their friends and family, they're not doing it.
Yeah.
Or if they have done it, to this day, they're wearing wigs because I come in contact with them as I ride around the city on the bus, and they're, and they kind of peel up the wig to show me that they're, you know, that they're bald, but they're just not comfortable. But you have to be comfortable.
Yes.
Because I can recall the hardest time for me or dealing with people were teenage boys 25 years ago, because I came down the street and they would just laugh and lay out in the street and go, and and at first I got upset. And then afterwards I thought about it and I said, you know what? Do I really care what they think?
Well, see, that's the same reaction me and my brothers had.
Yeah, you just think they're not important to my life. Mm-hmm. So why should I care what they think about me? Do I like it? Yes, then I'm going to do it.
Because all I knew, that was my mother. I didn't care.
Exactly.
You know.
But it just weaves its way through life. Because my mother was a hair person. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to do the raw egg for the conditioner, and this oil and that oil, what have you. I didn't tell her I was cutting off my hair. But when I did, she said, you don't look half bad. And I thought, victory.
Okay.
And there was never any pressure from her from that moment on to grow it back or do something else. I mean, the worst thing is that at one point I was thinking about tattooing my head. Because I thought Betty Boop ringlets would be great as a tattoo. And she looked at me, she said, girl, she said, your brain is inside that skull. You don't want tattoos.
I don't think so.
You know, and she just, that is a no-no. Mm-hmm. But other than that, she had no real thing to say about my bald head other than, oh, that looks nice.
So she just let you be your entire self.
Yes. But she was always like that. She was just, like I said, very easygoing and supportive.
Wonderful story. So, tell me about your ideas of growing up in America. How have you identified yourself as far as being a Black woman in America? Are you Black? Are you Negro? Are you African American? How do you see yourself in the whole spectrum of being Black in America?
Well, I guess when I look in the mirror, I just see me. Now, I happen to be Black, and that's fine, but I don't sit and dwell on that as my focus of life. My focus is on doing things that are creative. And I do the things that I love and that I enjoy. And when I had my son, I dragged him along to things that I did, and he got to see things, and we just lived our life. I can't spend my whole life thinking, I'm Black. Because I went into the fine jewelry industry when I was a young woman. Mm-hmm. I was actually probably a girl, because when I used to go shopping in the markets 47th Street and thereabout for fine jewelry, they called me girly. I didn't care. All I know is I'm here to buy X, and I need it at X price. You give me it that price, we got a deal, I'm fine, goodbye, I'll see you next time I need something. So I don't dwell on the fact that I'm African American. I am. My life experience has been that. I've lived in Harlem all of my life. I've spent time in my mid-years being bicontinental, because I was married to a gentleman from the Ivory Coast. Mm-hmm. So I'd be here half of the year, I'd be there. We just lived our life. We didn't say, oh, well, what do you call yourself? Sandy.
Gotcha. See, you were the first person that I talked to. A lot of times we make the simplest thing really complicated. You just said it in a nutshell. You're comfortable with yourself and you just went on with your life.
But that's all you can do. I mean, do you get up every morning and go stand in the mirror and do a dissertation on what color your skin is? No, because you've had that skin all your life.
Well, you know, I think for color, for black people, you know, us coming in all these different shades and different hues and stuff, sometimes that can be challenging.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. And folks are always possibly trying to fit in with some other people's image of what they should look like
exactly.
And what they should do.
Because I know coming up, most of my family is dark. And then we got a little rainbow going on in there. But color was never an issue. We never talked about that. Or we never referred to whoever was light skin or brown skin or whatever.
Exactly.
It was just whoever.
Right.
You know.
I know.
So you said you spent time in the Ivory Coast. Give me some experiences when you were there. Let's start with when you first got there. What did you think, being outside of America?
When I first got there, it was 1970. And I decided to go to Africa on my own, just because I wanted to see. I mean, I didn't know what to expect. And actually, 3 days before I left for the Ivory Coast, I'm walking down the street on 8th Street in East Village. And this gentleman comes toward me and says, "Hello there." Loved the French accent, so I spoke back. And he said, you know, I said, "Where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Africa." And I said, "Huh." I said, "Africa's a big place. Where exactly are you from?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "The Ivory Coast." Really? I got so, so excited because I knew I was going in a couple of days. So he said to me, "Well, have you picked out where you're going to stay?" And I said, "No, I haven't really sorted that out yet." He said, "Well, let me give you a hint. Just go to Cité Rouge. Just tell him Cité Rouge." And then I said, "You know, I don't speak French." He said, "You'll find somebody at the airport. They will be able to help you." Gotta tell you, I'm still looking for that person at the airport.
You never found them?
Never found them. But I remembered Cité Rouge. So I dragged my bag out to the front, and I, you know, there were lots of cab drivers, and I picked a guy who had a red scarf on because I liked it. And I went up to him and I said, "Cité Rouge." I didn't give him a chance to ask me anything because I wouldn't have understood what he was asking.
Okay.
I just knew I wanted to go, and I knew he was a cab driver. And he said, "Okay." And I got in, and we went to Cité Rouge, which was going from like Manhattan to Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was the University of Abidjan, you know, and it was glorious looking, but it was a huge campus, but it was surrounded by dirt roads, and I got out.
And you did what from there?
I stood there thinking, okay, what's next? And I was just fortunate enough to be there when some students, Ivorian students who were studying English, came out of class. And they looked at me and they said, they thought I looked foreign, but not foreign from America. They thought I was foreign from some other African country.
Okay.
So they approached me and one of them said something in English. And when I spoke back, it was like, you could see the light bulb go off in their head. And they said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "America." And they were like thrilled to death because now they were going to get a chance to speak English with an American, you know, so they could practice. And that began my African trip.
So all the stars were aligned for you.
They had to be aligned because how could all of these things work out and me not know where I'm going and end up in a really safe place that was comfortable? It was, I think, a break so that what students weren't full on campus. So someone said, "Well, where are you going to stay?" I said, "I don't know." They said, "Okay, wait." And someone ran and got the dormitory manager. Came back to me. Now he spoke fluent English. And he asked me, you know, how long I was going to be there. And I told him, I think at the time I was scheduled to be there about 20 days or so. And he said, "Would you like to stay in the dormitory?" I said, "Well, how much is it?" He told me, $4 a day with two meals.
Unheard of.
Unheard of. Couldn't comprehend. Thought, oh, this could be very nice. And he said, I'd have a private room. The kitchen would connect to someone on the other side, another female. And she has a refrigerator. And if you want to use the refrigerator, you've got to contribute some money if you want to keep things cold. And the bathroom is down the hall. And for me, that was perfect. Mm-hmm. I was a young woman, you know, by myself. Didn't know where I was going, just wanted my experience in Africa. So that's where I started. I had a couple of other countries I went to after that.
That's a great story.
Yes. Well, I just went. I initially had gone to a travel agent, and she had mapped out this plan for me, but she kept trying, took me into travel groups, places, and I was like, no, that's not what I want to do.
I want to be alone,
but also I like to, when I go places, even now, I like to be with the real people. Amongst the people, that's how you find out what the country is really like. And so I canceled her, and I made a plan of my own, and I went to Africa, to the horror of most of my family. Because, you know, the contrast at the time was Africa. Why do you want to go to Africa?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're not African. Mm-hmm. You're American. And I said, I'm going. I want to know. And it had started because I was working in Harlem at a store called Ashanti. Mm-hmm. Ashanti Bazaar. They were on 137th Street and 7th Avenue. And I had met this man, Blee, who was an African trader. Now at that time, African artifacts and stuff, he was traveling in a giant truck and he was driving around the US. We hadn't got to the point where they set up outside like the MoMA like they do now. Mm-hmm. And that hadn't started yet. And he's popped into the store because he said he saw the name Ashanti. And he said he wanted to see who was involved and did we know what Ashanti meant and all of that. Mm-hmm. So he came in, a very nice gentleman. And so I said to him, can I see what's in your truck? Went outside, had to climb up, you know, because it was a big truck. Climbed up, and when I stepped in that truck, it was like stepping into Africa. It was so beautiful. It had cloth, it had carvings, it had masks. I mean, you name it, little gold weights, everything was in this truck. And I think at that point I decided, I have to see Africa.
Okay.
And that's how I started.
Okay. So how did you meet your husband?
He was one of the people I met.
While you're there?
While I was there. We didn't initially get married. Well, we went back and forth and exclusively dated for about 3 years. Because part of what happened with him and being understanding of the things I wanted to see, we traveled through the Ivory Coast and went to different places. And I kind of cataloged things I saw that I thought we could sell back here in the country. But I didn't want to be a trader, dealer, having to, you know, do what Blee had done and drive around and try and sell things.
Okay.
So I became a foreign shopping agent. So I would tell people the kinds of things that I could possibly get for them. They would give me money, and when I went, I would do the shopping. And it was nice. And it paid for the trip back and forth.
That sounds like an adventure.
It was fun. I enjoyed it. I had such a good time.
Did any of your friends, were they interested in taking part in this?
No.
No?
No. My friends were, most of them were artists and doing things. They were more interested in doing whatever they were doing.
Okay.
If I was shopping here in the city and going to, you know, an African dealer here in the city, they might want to go along to see what was there. But in terms of traveling, no.
Mm-mm. Okay, so you had the whole ball game by yourself.
Yes, and I became known, at least in the Ivory Coast initially, as the woman from America. Because they hadn't experienced an African-American person coming to shop in the marketplaces on a regular basis.
Mm.
So they would remember me, save things for me that they thought I might like.
So you developed a lot of relationships.
I developed relationships.
Okay.
And I thought it was a great life.
Okay, so were the people that you initially met, mm-hmm, from the university, did you ever keep in touch with them, or had you?
I kept in touch with them, several of them, for a long time until some of them passed away and whatnot.
Okay.
But the gentleman who I met crossing 8th Street, mm-hmm, in the village, we're still friends. He lives up in the Bronx.
Okay.
Yeah. Just, you know, things happen and you just
go with it.
You go with it.
You go with the feeling.
Yes, 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 yes.
Okay, let's talk about religion, spirituality. How does that play a part in your life?
How does it play a part in my life? Well, I believe in God, and I'm religious. I'm not an average churchgoer, because of some of the experiences I had when I was little. And it just irritated me that the people at the church seemed to be very judgmental. and they're paying more attention to what you were wearing, you know, than anything else. And I just said, I don't like that. So I talked to my mother, and I think she must have had similar experiences. So at some point she gave me a choice. Do you want to go or not? And I chose not to go, and she never bothered me about it again.
Was your mother a churchgoer?
Limited, because of her experiences, you know, with the community. She didn't. She was different in the sense that she was born here. My grandmother sent her back to Jamaica, West Indies, to live with her father. And so my mother was in Jamaica until she was 15 years old. And then she came back here. So the culture was a little cross-cultural thing going on. And I don't think that some of the people here accepted her as readily because, you know, she had the heavy Caribbean accent, mm-hmm. and she was, you know, she was Jamaican, although she was born here. And so I think she had some difficulties, but, you know, she didn't let it stop her. She mm-hmm. just enjoyed her life as well.
Because it was interesting, the person I talked to earlier, when we came to church and religion, what have you, she said that she went to church, her siblings went to church, but the parents didn't go to church. And the same thing with myself. My parents sent us to church, but they didn't go to church. And my mother said that she came from a spiritual background where her grandmother, they went to church on a regular basis. And my mother has two other sisters. She has a twin sister and her younger sister. My youngest aunt, between the three of them, she was more spiritual.
Okay.
Because coming up, she would study all different types of religions. Because I remember she went through the Baptist, she went with the Buddhist, there's a couple other things. But she stayed, you know, enlightening herself
right.
with all these different type of religions or whatever. Where my mother and her other sister, I think they were more spiritual than religious.
Yes.
I believe there's a higher power, but I don't think I need to devote myself to an organization. Because just like what you're saying, I had bad experiences coming through Catholic school, and it sort of kind of marked and scarred me as far mm-hmm. as attaching myself to a religion.
Exactly. I understand.
You know, so I tend to move in a different direction. You know, every once in a while, I do go to church. I visit church. I can remember growing up Catholic and then going to experience the so-called black church. It scared the hell out of me because there was so much emotion and so many things was going on that I hadn't experienced that in the Catholic church because it was
right.
so bland.
Bland, yes. Well, I was Episcopalian, so I was on the bland side also.
So even now, if I go to a church, my heart is racing.
Okay.
I don't know what it is, but it's just something in that the aura when I entered the building.
Okay.
I don't know whether it's something that possesses me or whatever. And then I remember years ago I went to see the Gospel at Colonna's.
Okay, I remember that.
With Morgan Freeman,
yes.
A lot of people was on display. And it was so much energy going on the stage that it poured out into the audience. And it was like church. People were jumping in the aisles and getting the Holy Ghost. And I think I was this close to jumping in the aisles.
Whoa.
But that Catholic experience, it brought me back to that being conservative. And you sit there,
retreat.
Keep your hands folded, and don't lose your composure. But I was like, now, do I get up now? But it didn't happen, but all the time that I was sitting there, it was a good feeling, but I just couldn't come to terms with letting go.
Okay.
I, for whatever reason it was, I couldn't let go. And when people ask me, have I ever, you know, felt the Holy Ghost, I think that is the closest thing that I can say that I felt.
Right.
What people have described.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I can understand.
So, yeah.
Let's see.
What else?
I'll tell you.
Are you a part of any kind of social group? Black Lives Matter, NAACP, Black Panthers, you know, throughout your life? Have you been a part of any kind of social organization?
Not especially. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I have supported organizations like that because I think, you know, we have organizations that work that need people to support them. And while I'm not one who's going to be out there marching and screaming and shouting, I could be screaming and shouting in my living room saying, all right, go ahead, mm-hmm. all right, and I can support that. Right now, I think the only organization I actively support is African Voices, mm-hmm. which is, you know, about getting Black folks' words written and printed and out there in the world. I think it's really, really important that we all start telling all of our stories. And in fact, I'm working on a memoir myself about all of the experiences I've had, because how else are we going to be recorded if we don't write down our stories? Things are happening so fast now, mm-hmm. all over the place, that we need to document this wonderful creative energy that we have bestowed on the world someplace, so that somebody else can look at a later date and go back and say, oh yes, I remember Bo, blah, 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 blah. But if we don't write it down, or if it's not recorded somewhere, it's gone. We came, we lived, and we died.
Right. Well, that's one of the reasons why, Sandy, that we created this program.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's absolutely essential. It's like, come on, people. You know, we're now in 2017.
Yeah, so we can document these stories.
Gotta be documented. I mean, in terms of even the stories that we use to make films, I think I was most moved by Hidden Treasures, mm-hmm. about the African-American women who were involved in the space program.
I hadn't heard that story before.
I was speechless, and I kept thinking, I remember the time. I remember when I was in school. I remember them going up in space.
But
no mention of us. Mm-hmm. And we were integral. I thought, no, we've got to do better. And we need to know, because personally I thought, you know, maybe if I had known what was going on, I could have leaned towards science.
Yeah, it could have took you in a different direction.
Totally different direction. But I didn't know. So I am really one for, yes, recording the stories, telling your stories, letting everybody know so that we don't become hidden and forgotten.
Well, I think it's probably millions of hidden treasures that we don't know about.
Oh, well, look at your dime. Mm-hmm. Your dime piece was carved by an African-American woman. So it's like, okay, here we go. It's just everywhere.
It is.
It's so obvious, but because we haven't been told and they don't say it, we don't know. And, you know, you get caught up in your life and living and making a living and raising children and doing all those things that you don't necessarily have the time to do the research that would be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. But the great part about now is technology and the internet, where you can push a button and type in something and you can get the information right then and there. But at the same time, you got to know what you're looking for.
Right.
When you hit that button and you type in whatever it is that's out there that you're trying to gravitate towards.
Right.
That's the great part about technology.
That is wonderful, and technology will be even better. We have all of our information there so that when you hit the button, you'll find what you're looking for.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think it's marvelous.
Exactly. Because, again, I was talking earlier about the youth of today. You know, it was a time when we played all kind of physical games, jumping rope.
Jacks,
wall ball, paddle ball, king ball.
Yes.
That's been lost. When has the last time you walked down the street and you seen girls jump rope?
I can't remember.
That was an everyday thing one time.
Yes, it was. I remember playing volleyball in the street at PAL.
Yes.
I mean, all of those things were really wonderful. And they're not existing right now.
No. Because I remember when Spike Lee did Crooklyn.
Right.
He said he had to teach all those kids those games. That they weren't familiar with it.
Wow. Okay. Absolutely amazing.
It is. And I can remember people's parents jumping rope mm-hmm. and playing jacks. Because my aunt used to play jacks. She was really good at jacks. And she used to play wall ball. You don't even see the kids. I know the baseball and all the athletic stuff are still there, but it's not like really in your face in the community.
Right. No, it isn't. Look, I get excited when I see a child hold a book.
Exactly. Because now book is, that's another little gadget.
I know, but just a regular book. I'm going.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. You know, I hope and pray that books don't become obsolete.
I hope not.
Because, you know, you can get a book on this.
No, but it's
but not the same thing.
No, you got to be able to
turn the page. You got to fill the page.
Yes. Oh, yes, 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 yes. No, it's not the same at all. I hope that book survive.
Because even, I love magazines. And, you know, when all this online publication came out, I was saying to myself, are they going to kill magazines now? Because, you know, coming up as a kid, I had stacks and stacks of magazines. I love magazines. But in a sense, I think there's going to be a balance.
Oh, I think there will be. Because there's still things that are on the printed page that you want on that printed page. And you want to keep them.
Yeah.
I mean, what I started doing, because I was also one of those magazine people, but it got to the point where I had so many magazines, I said, okay, for the ones that are not wonderful on every page, I would remove the pages that I really loved.
Yes.
And put them in plastic sleeves.
Yes.
And keep those, and then I kept the other magazines intact. Because some of the stuff is going to be lost.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gonna fall off the edge, not intentionally, but just happens.
Because my mom told me that her and my aunt, when they were kids, they were around a lot of decorating magazines. And she said they used to take tear the pages out and say, oh, this is what my house is gonna look like, and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, I think part of it, it could be fantasy, it can be, you know, encouraging you on, you know, how you wanna live your life, where you wanna go in your life, just by a picture or by the written word.
Oh, most definitely.
That you can see, touch, and feel.
Yes. All our senses are still alive and we need to use them all jointly.
Yes.
And you can do that with the stuff.
Yes.
Like this wonderful table.
Okay, we're going to get to the table in 1 minute. But how familiar are you with the I-2 poem?
I-2 poem?
Yeah,
Lines and Years. I'm not that familiar with it.
Yeah, same here. I'm familiar with the Rivers poem. I'm familiar with Langston Hughes. I told a story earlier that a couple years ago I read this article speaking about the state of the Langston Hughes house. And the address was in the paper in the article, and I came around here and I stood outside and all this ivy was covered in front of the brownstone. And I just stood out there and I just was a daydream about what was inside, what was he like,
right?
Who came through here, because I'm sure it was a lot of literary people came,
of course.
Entertainers. I think I stood outside maybe an hour, just like daydreaming. And then here I am today, I'm on the inside, and I created work for this project in honor of him.
Isn't that wonderful?
You know?
That's
so,
spectacular.
In closing, do you have any comments on the table?
Do I have any comments on the table? I wish it was foldable and I could just pack it up and take it with me. That's about the only comment I have, because it's fascinating. The details that are on this table are so, so wonderful. You've got the different textures, the different colors, the ones that are carved, the ones that are painted, the resin-infused ones. There's just so much to look at, that it's absolutely extraordinary.
Actually, this is my remix version of the American flag.
Oh, makes sense, because that's what we really are about.
Yeah.
If people want to pay attention, because when they want to talk about go back to Africa, I look at some of these other people thinking, well, then you need to go back to Germany or France or Belgium.
Thank you.
Or wherever. Because you're not from here either. And it infuriates me sometimes. Because it's like, suddenly, as you know, can I say, some folks want to claim things. It's like, okay, we're here, so this is ours. No.
With all this gentrification going on in Harlem right now.
It's rough. It's rough.
Well, yeah, this is 4 months of hard labor.
It's a glorious result. That's all I can say. It's not like you say, what'd you do for 4 months?
Oh, now we're working, trust me.
But that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. You can't look at this and not say, wow, look at the detail. Look at the carving, you just want to run your hands all over all of this stuff and go, ooh.
So yeah, the masks represent the Africans, and the flowers represent, tributing the Africans that came to America.
Okay.
The anchors represent the slave ships, the docking of the slave ships. This red, white, and blue dollar store bag.
Right.
That represents the poor and the underprivileged. That we're still building this country. This is commerce, this is us still growing, still making this country great. And this is us in the slave field. The cloth buttons represent the cotton. The burlap is the cotton sack that they put the cotton in.
Yeah.
And then the wood buttons, they're all different hues. So that's us,
yes.
Black folks in all different colors, all different hues.
It's an extraordinary
textures.
Piece.
And then I have black enslaved men all throughout here.
It's absolutely amazing, beautiful.
And then this thread is the sun beaming down on the field. And this thread is the money being made off the backs of these us. And then underneath, it's all currency from a dollar bill to a $100 bill attached to the roots of slavery and the roots of evil.
Just running my hand under the bottom, it just feels.
Yeah, back to texture.
The texture. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Because even when I do it, it's the sound, it's the texture, even the smell. Because sometimes when I find bags of buttons.
There's a smell.
Yeah, they've been in them bags for so long.
Yes.
So my thing is that I'm giving them a permanent life. I'm letting them breathe again, letting them live again.
Live again.
Because this will be their permanent destination.
Nice place to end up.
So, Sandy, I want to thank you for taking part in my project.
You are more than welcome. It has been an absolute pleasure to be part of this.
Thank you so much.